Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. This week, we're bringing back some of the biggest storylines of the summer to thank you, our listeners, for keeping us on the air and making this kind of place-based informative storytelling possible. Gillette welcomed over 55,000 people for a week-long event this August.
What a welcoming town. I mean, the Camperee is like twice the size of Gillette, and they want us. That's so awesome. It's like, Gillette, shout out. Thank you. Love you, Gillette. Thanks for having us.
And we'll bring you behind the scenes of one of the biggest fires in Wyoming this summer.
Everybody is expecting action and everything, but like behind the action, it's like there's more action.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us. Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Today, as we leave the summer behind us, Wyoming Public Radio takes a look back at some of the biggest headlines. In July, Yellowstone National Park came out with its long-awaited updated bison plan. It allows the herd to grow by about 1,000 more than the area has seen in the past decade. The herd has been around 5,000 animals. Park biologists say the land can handle even more bison, but it's limited by the amount of winter habitat outside the park in Montana. The state's governor has threatened to constrict how far bison can roam there. Meanwhile, the manager of a bison herd on the Wind River Indian Reservation hopes the park will grow its herd so he can grow his tribes too. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports.
Wow, you got some bison hair right here.
Oh, yeah.
The cup holders and Jason Baldus's side-by-side are filled with clumps of bison hair. He manages about 120 bison for the Eastern Shoshone tribe. On a windy June day, we find about a dozen males munching on grass.
Where did this bison hair come from?
Right outside the window. All these buffalo are losing their winter coat right now, so they're all sloughing off.
15 of the tribe's bison came from Yellowstone's herd, and Baldus is hoping to receive more under the park's recently signed bison management plan. The plan replaces one from more than 20 years ago. This new plan prioritizes transferring bison to tribes along with tribal hunts to keep the herd size between 3,500 and 6,000 animals. Baldus hoped the park would up the herd to 7,000, one of the three options considered in the planning process, but he says their choice of 6,000 is a good compromise. He says he's glad the park made the decision based on factors like habitat availability and didn't cave to political pressures.
Buffalo have been subjected to the whims of the stock growers and the cattle industry for forever, since cattle arrived. That status quo is something that needs to be challenged.
Since 2001, around 11,700 bison were removed from the Yellowstone herd as part of an interagency agreement to maintain a free-roaming bison population while preventing conflicts and disease transmission. More than half were sent to slaughter in a program where meats and hides are given to tribes. But in recent years, the park is trying to move away from slaughtering so many animals. It's been scaling up its capacity to transfer bison to tribes. Thousands of bison are also hunted just outside the park in Montana. Chris Jeremiah is Yellowstone's bison biologist. He says Yellowstone can easily handle 6,000 bison.
There is plenty of grassland and plenty of habitat in this park for more bison than that. But the conflict with bison occurs in the wintertime, and we have to take into account the amount of habitat that's allowed for them by the state of Montana.
In the winter, sometimes bison migrate outside of park boundaries. The livestock industry and Montana's governor are worried that bison could give a reproductive disease called brucellosis to cattle. Governor Greg Gianforte wants to limit the herd size to 3,000. In letters responding to the plan, his office accused the Park Service of failing to incorporate the state's concerns as the plan was developed and said Montana may reduce the tolerance zones where bison are allowed outside the park.
The question is why? Why would you change the tolerance zones? That's the question for the state.
That's Yellowstone's superintendent, Cam Shawley. He says the park is keeping the herd at the same size it's been for the past 10 to 15 years, and that reducing it to 3,000 would require slaughtering a massive amount of bison each year. That's not something the park wants to do.
I don't understand the logic We haven't had a brucellosis transmission between bison and cattle.
In Wyoming, wildlife officials say increasing the Yellowstone herd will have minimal impacts. A Wyoming Game and Fish spokesperson said that's because the bison they manage primarily migrate out of Grand Teton National Park.
So this is, we generally call this the overlook.
Back at Wind River, Baldus points to a range unit recently converted from cattle to bison habitat. It'll increase bison habitat for his tribe's herd by more than 8 times.
Everything south of the river is that 17,000 acre range unit. So we're getting ready to begin construction on that fence line that'll go around the 17,000 acres.
Fence construction starts this month, and there are plans to combine the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho bison herds, growing the total number of bison at Wind River to more than 200. While Baldus is confident he'll receive more Yellowstone bison from the transfer program, it's not yet clear when or how many. He's hopeful more bison in Yellowstone will mean more bison here.
My vision is thousands of buffalo on tens to hundreds of thousands of acres, restoring migration and corridor, and a real contribution to the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
For now, the park will manage for under 6,000 animals. More than 100 are slated to be transferred to tribes each year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Olivia Wheats at the Center of the West in Cody.
Gillette wrapped up a pretty busy week in August, hosting the International Pathfinder Camporee. The town nearly doubled in size while accommodating the week-long youth camp and worship event. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger heard how big events like this fit into the city's future.
Gillette has been working on their Camplex facility for years, adding event centers and gymnasiums, porta potties and parking lots, many of these improvements made in anticipation of some 50 to 60,000 youth campers with the Seventh-day Adventist Church visiting for 1 week. A daunting number for any Wyoming town, but equally an opportunity to see how Gillette likes being a national and sometimes international destination.
Gillette has been so friendly. I love Wyoming.
That's Jeff Sewell from California.
What a welcoming town. I mean, the Camporee is like twice the size of Gillette, and they want us. That's so awesome. It's like, Gillette, shout out. Thank you. Love you, Gillette. Thanks for having us.
Sewell, like many other pastors, leaders, and youth ministers, arrived in Gillette the weekend prior to assist with preparations for the thousands of young Pathfinders on their way. Pathfinders are like Boy and Girl Scouts, but with the church, made up of clubs and conferences from around the planet, gathering once every 5 years for a week of worship. Once arrived in Gillette, they turned the Camplex into a sort of city campus, complete with classes, expos, temporary bus stops, golf cart transports, and a seemingly endless flow of RVs. Some, like J. Air Sosa from Minnesota, came prepared with water, fire extinguishers, and even power generators for his Pathfinder group.
Just like those little things that the campers and their families might not know about when they come, and they might forget. And you know, it's not super easy to just run out to Walmart with 55,000 other campers that also forgot, you know, a toothbrush.
And it looks like many campers did. The local Walmart was densely packed with shoppers gathering basic supplies and food. The added influx of people also caused congestion around highway exits and the Camplex facilities as well. That wasn't a bother for some, but a hassle for others. Lonnie Flack is with Black Hills Trucking.
When 60,000 come in, it's times three, so everything you go and do is three times more ruckus.
He says it caused delays for his business.
You know, it's just a rat race when more people show up to town, kind of messes up your schedule, so I'm not a fan.
Downtown businesses weren't sure what to expect. Many prepared for an above-average amount of new customers, like Michelle Sarah, owner of Hands-On Pottery.
It's been long hours.
Sarah brought her business to the campers. She set up a booth in the Camplex for Pathfinders to paint commemorative art piece keepsakes. Sarah said it's a popular craft, and she had to increase the seating to accommodate how many people signed up for classes later in the week.
Now, the people that have signed up for the offsite, which is here at our studio, that is already full. People have already signed up and registered and whatnot.
Up the street, Casey Mills, who owns the Teachers Corners Kids Mart, said she'd been looking forward to the event.
We're all very excited to see everybody. We love meeting people, and we have a map up here to so everybody can put where they're from on the map.
In a follow-up call to Mills, she said that the event was overall a good thing for the community. She appreciated the community service projects done by Pathfinders and that they cleaned up after themselves nicely.
I just think it has to do with what our town can handle and how people treat it. And, yeah. And I think people would like to see more events at the complex, which I think is great too, but to the size of the campery, maybe not so much all the time.
Gillette voters also made that clear when they approved a tax to help build an outdoor, multi-use arena at the complex, one that may host major rodeo events in the future. City Administrator Mike Cole agrees with Mills, suggesting the Camperee was a massive undertaking, but other complex events could help to grow Gillette's travel industry.
You know, concerts, trade shows, similar type outdoor recreation events. We're looking forward to promoting the success of this event with other future events.
Ultimately, Camperee goers got the full Wyoming experience. Some enjoyed the beautiful sunsets, some visited downtown Gillette, some took time to visit Devil's Tower. However, everyone got to see Western weather firsthand. A severe storm sent many campers inside the complex to seek shelter early in the week, and weather eventually shut down the Friday night stage show, as well as sending some campers home early. Regardless of the last-minute rainout, the Pathfinders website has the next Camperee set for August 6th to 12th, 2029. Location, this little place on the map called Gillette, Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Up next on Open Spaces, how does AI fit in newsrooms, if at all? Stay with us. Welcome back to our special Open Spaces Pledge Week episode, where we revisit some of the summer's biggest headlines. Newsrooms around the country are talking about how to use AI in the wake of a recent journalism scandal in our region. A reporter in Cody resigned after he was caught using the technology to write stories and fabricate quotes. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach has more.
Reporter C.J. Baker was sitting in his cubicle at the Powell Tribune office in northwest Wyoming when his editor started reading an article out loud.
Yellowstone National Park, known for its stunning landscapes and diverse wildlife, is a place where visitors come to experience nature's beauty.
It was from a competing paper, the Cody Enterprise.
This incident serves as a stark reminder of the unpredictable nature of human behavior, even in the most serene settings.
His editor thought that was a weird way to end a story about a shootout, especially one in which someone died.
I turned to him, I said, I know where that comes from. And I said, that's AI.
Baker says it sounded a lot like writing he'd seen from a chatbot. Still, he says suspecting another paper's reporter was using AI wasn't a story in itself. But then he started finding other parts of stories that he thought were made up. So he reached out to people who'd been quoted by the reporter in Cody. Seven people said they'd never talked to him, including the governor, an astronomer, and a raccoon expert.
I think there's a lot of room for disagreement in journalism about how best to do things, but the red line is that you never make stuff up.
At a think tank in Florida, one of the leading experts on AI was also intrigued.
I couldn't stop thinking about it. I had never heard of a reporter using AI to generate quotes yet.
Alex Mahadevan is with the Poynter Institute. Baker got his take on the situation before publishing his investigation. Mahadevan had seen other kinds of misuses of the technology, like having AI write stories and creating fake bylines. But not like this. He says things like that Yellowstone paragraph are a dead giveaway.
So you might see a paragraph that tries to sum up the situation and wrap it up in like a nice bow that, you know, somebody would try to write on their SAT.
The scandal was picked up by media outlets around the country, and reporters have continued to talk about the ramifications. For his part, Mahadevan is a big proponent of using some AI in journalism, especially in small newsrooms.
They should be using generative AI to do transcription, meeting summaries, to try to cover more communities, experimenting with ethical but innovative ways to do your jobs better.
But he says it's critical to have a clear public policy on how it's being used. The Cody Enterprise reporter who resigned is not commenting, but the paper's leaders apologized and said they now have a system in place to catch AI-generated stories. The Powell Tribune, which uncovered the scandal, is also working on developing a policy. And other newsrooms around Wyoming are paying attention.
I'm Sarah Squires. I'm the managing editor of The Ranger, Wind River News, and Lander Journal newspapers.
Over in central Wyoming, Squires runs a pretty traditional newsroom. The walls are plastered with calendars and story ideas. The radio and a police scanner run in the background. Squires' newsroom has a policy of not using AI. And when news of the use in Cody broke, she made sure to tell her audiences that in an editorial. And she's making sure she knows what all of her writers' voices sound like, so she could detect any AI.
AI will never be something that we use for writing, but we do see potential out there in terms of maybe using AI to like sort large volumes of data.
But she's also keeping her reporters focused on basic techniques like talking to people and opening up books instead of always relying on computers.
Walk on your two legs and go to the library, go to the historical society.
And do that kind of old-fashioned reporting. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Mersbach in Jackson.
Back in September, the Fish Creek Fire had been burning for nearly a month up on Togedy Pass. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reported from the fire's base camp on how a camp crew from the Wind River Reservation's been tackling the behind-the-scenes work needed to keep the operation running.
Right off Highway 26/287, going up Togedy Pass, a dirt RV parking lot the size of a football field has been turned into a temporary town, as hundreds of firefighters work to protect the surrounding cabins, lodges, and roads.
This is a very, very busy spot because this is essentially the center of fire activity from a logistical standpoint.
That's Morgan Faber, the base camp manager for the forward operating base that's set up just south of Togedy Lodge on the west side of the fire. Every morning, the parking lot is packed for the daily briefing.
This is completely full of cars, and we have about another 75 vehicles out on the highway.
There's a big dining tent, a trailer with showers, catering kitchens, a medical tent, a mechanic, and even a mobile gas station.
They run over the thing and a ding ding, and the guy comes out and he'll help fuel up any of the trucks.
It's all set up to support the firefighters who are camped in a big field a few miles away. They work together with the Incident Command Center located on the east side of the fire in Dubois.
We're just in charge of, you know, making sure everything that is here in base camp, from porta potties, dumpsters, all of the lovely behind the scenes things that everyone needs, that's kind of what we manage.
This temporary town doesn't just appear. It takes work to set up and to run.
We build a town and then we tear it down. And it's really amazing to see how that process works. And without our camp crews around, I don't know how we would be able to get it done.
Enter Wind River Camp Crew Number 1, a team from the Wind River Reservation that tackles all those odds and ends. Teresa Swimmer is Northern Arapaho and from Fort Washakie. First up on their agenda, get up and make coffee.
Wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning. First duty is to get to breakfast, get that done, counting the meals for the catering, hand out lunches to the firefighters, wipe down tables, pick up trash. When the trucks come in, we unload ice, we unload Gatorade.
After a break while the firefighters are out for the day, Swimmer and her team do it again for the dinner rush. She's been working on Camp Crew for 15 years and says the work is hard, but they get through it together.
We're doing an awesome job and we all appreciate each other and we're all communicating. And that's where basically it's mostly at is communication.
During that midday break, the 10-person crew grabbed folding chairs and crammed into one of the yurts to talk all things Camp Crew. Tara Jorgensen is Eastern Shoshone and is a first year on the crew. She says her least favorite thing is
getting up super, super early, but hey, it comes with the job.
She says the flip side is learning new things every day.
Everybody is expecting action and everything, but like behind the action, it's like there's more action.
Mavis Willow is Northern Arapaho and Camp Crew boss.
I love being out here. I love camping. I just like to be on my feet all the time and just, you know, stay as young as possible as I can.
She's from Ithity and says working in the fire world runs in the family.
My father, he was a World War II veteran and he kind of disciplined us that way. And he was a firefighter also. And the whole family, just as they grew up, they joined him.
That tradition is still getting passed on. Willow has two grandkids on the crew, but she says it's all business on the job.
I'm not grandma here, but I'm their boss.
Jason Stevenson, Northern Arapaho, is from Fort Washakie and used to be a firefighter.
I got some bumps and bruises that I can't heal up like I used to when I was young. So, you know, camp crew is a lot better, a lot more easier than being out there in the mountains fighting fire.
Stevenson's been stationed at the supply yard and is training to take on the receiving and distributing manager role at fire camp.
For me, it's way to advance further into this, you know, as I'm getting older, turn into the career side of it.
As for what keeps him coming back?
There's a lot of things about this country that, you know, we want to save and keep part of our country and just practically being part of the whole team. And it feels good when you know it's finally out, everything's done, and you did your part to help out.
While most fire assignments are 14 days, the Wind River Camp crew was asked to extend for one more week, thanks to all their hard work. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman from the Fish Creek Fire Operating Base.
Maybe the biggest news of the summer? Wyoming's primary election. That's up next on Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Today, as we leave summer behind us, Wyoming Public Radio is taking a look back at some of the biggest headlines. Perhaps the biggest, Wyoming's primary election. For the rest of the show, we're going to focus on stories that paint the picture before and after the primary. Let's start with the lead-up. For some Wyomingites, mailboxes, emails, and voicemails overflowed with election-related literature. Maggie Mullen is a reporter at Wildfile who worked with a team of her colleagues to look into some of these mailers, texts, phone calls, and door knocks to get a sense of who's trying to sway your vote. Mullen sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woollett to share what she learned.
Let's start with one that was sent out to voters in Albany County's Senate District 10. How did you first learn about these mailers? Did you get one?
So I actually didn't get one of these mailers, and I first heard about them from voters who had. The one we're talking about has this yellow font, a picture of a bear sort of darkened in the background, and it talked about gun rights. But then the photograph on it stood out to us because there's a candidate there by the name of Keith Kennedy. We knew what he looked like, and we knew that the photograph was not showing that man. And so that's kind of what started us off looking more into, okay, well, what's going on in this mailer? Who is the man in this photo? And of course, nowadays we have access to new types of technology that allow us to search Google for images. And that's when we found out the man that is pictured is actually of the same name. His name is Keith Kennedy. He lives in Virginia and he worked for the U.S. Senate for a number of years. And so he had a photo taken of that time. And that photo is the first thing you find when you Google the name Keith Kennedy. So that reporting process eventually brought me to tracking down that gentleman's contact info and giving him a call to also ask, are you aware that your photograph is being used in mailers? And he wasn't.
Tell me more about this group, Make Liberty Win, who sent out this particular mailer. What have you been able to find out about them, and what kind of issues or particular candidates are they promoting here in Wyoming?
They are a political action committee, and they formed a few years ago. This is a very well-funded political machine. Just since the beginning of 2023, they've been able to raise a little over $8.7 million. Most of that money has come from Texas. I looked through their FEC filings.
That's the Federal Election Commission?
Yes. And I didn't find any donations from Wyoming. So it's fair to call them that they're completely out of state political action committee. Through my reporting, I've not ever been able to get in touch with them. But for whatever reason, the PAC has decided to involve itself in legislative races in Wyoming, which aligns also with goals on their website. I think it's, quote, electing 250 liberty-defending state legislators across the country. And so it's not just Wyoming. There's been some reporting in Idaho about some significant amount of money that they've spent there. But they have been very active. They have had several different mailers go out. And most of those mailers, not all, but the majority of those mailers have been in support of candidates who are either members of or ideologically aligned with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. And that's a group of hardline Republicans in the House that have been organizing, formed a few years ago, and they're looking to take majority in the House this election.
Thinking about some of the other materials that Make Liberty Win is sharing in Wyoming, have you noticed other inaccuracies?
Yes, some of those inaccuracies have been about early voting dates, which is underway. But they also, and they did this in this particular mailer in Albany County, they frequently referred to candidates who are challengers as incumbents. If a voter comes across one of these mailers, they might be under the impression that a challenger running for their district is actually someone who's already gotten this job once before and they've done it before.
What have you heard from voters about receiving this kind of literature?
A lot of the feedback that Wildfile has gotten has been a lot of disappointment and a lot of shock. This type of campaigning is new to Wyoming. At least that's what I've heard from voters. I think this sort of flavor of campaigning of big out-of-state money providing mailers to voters that is not just inaccurate, but really just sort of outlandish in its inaccuracies. And we won't really know until this first campaign finance deadline just how much money is being spent right now. But I think voters are also getting this impression that there is a lot of money being spent.
Separately, the Wyoming Freedom PAC has recently been sued by two lawmakers. And these two lawmakers from Sweetwater County are claiming that mailers were sent out by the PAC criticizing them for votes that they say never happened. What is the backstory on that one?
Yeah, so this political action committee, it's sort of the fundraising arm for the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. It formed in 2023. And these mailers that have gone out, this is some of the first sort of large expenditures that we've seen come out of the PAC. And these mailers make several allegations against several lawmakers across the state. But the claim at the center of this defamation lawsuit is that the Wyoming Freedom PAC accuses several sitting lawmakers. They say this two different ways, that they either, quote, voted with the radical left to remove President Trump from the ballot, or they write, quote, this lawmaker voted no to keep President Trump on the ballot this fall. The Wyoming legislature has never in its history considered, debated, voted on any proposal to remove former President Donald Trump from the ballot. So these two lawmakers out of Sweetwater County are two freshman lawmakers, Representative J.T. Larson and Representative Cody Wiley. They've filed the suit. So we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, as far as why the Wyoming Freedom PAC would make these allegations, essentially, there was a footnote that while the House was debating the budget bill around whether or not the Secretary of State could enter or initiate out-of-state litigation without the approval of the legislature. The Secretary of State had been involved with litigation concerning, if listeners will remember, in Colorado, the Supreme Court there said Trump can't be on the ballot. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled them, but Secretary of State Chuck Gray was involved with an amicus brief in that case. And so lawmakers debated this back and forth. There was a vote as far as Do we want to keep this footnote or do we want to remove it? And it's that vote that folks at the Wyoming Freedom Pack say that was effectively a vote to remove Trump from the ballot.
I'm curious if you have a sense of the type of impact that this kind of electioneering political speech, does it get people out to vote?
The candidates who have been attacked by these mailers have told me, like when they've gone out door to door to talk to voters, that they've encountered some of the language in the mailers being spoken back to them from voters, you know, asking them, did you support this? Did you do this? I heard you did this. So candidates are coming up against that, that voters are getting these mailers and taking them at face value, at least to some degree.
So let's end on some news you can use. What advice do you have for voters as we wade into these final weeks of primary campaigning? Like, how are you spotting misinformation in mailers, in texts, emails?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure voters are feeling like they're getting a fire hose of information, but I think that's why it's that much more important to, you know, any kind of political mailer that you get, your baseline should be skepticism, but also to, you know, do a little bit of digging yourself. And if you feel like I can't do that digging myself, to call up your local news, your local Wyoming Public Radio or WyoFile, and we'll see what we can do to help you out.
Well, Maggie Mullen, reporter at WyoFile, thank you so much for sharing your reporting about these mailers that are going out and misinformation in the upcoming election.
Thanks, Nikki. Appreciate it.
It is standard practice for voting equipment to be tested before an election, both the primary and the general. This year was no different. About 2 weeks before the August primary, all 23 county clerks in the state tested their voting equipment. But at least three counties' results were not in accordance with a line in the Wyoming Election Code. At least that was according to the Wyoming GOP. They provided evidence for Goshen, Laramie, and Albany counties, but claimed other counties also were in violation. So what is this law? What did the machines do wrong? And can we trust that voting will be secure and just in the upcoming election? These are some of the questions that we sought to answer. And we're going to start with what's in the state election code. It calls for a different number of votes to be assigned to each candidate when testing voting equipment. This law has been in the books for a while, and it turns out that a couple of other states have a similar code. To understand why this line is important, I called Pamela Smith.
I'm president and CEO of Verified Voting.
Verified Voting is an organization that promotes responsible use of technology in elections. Smith is actually aware of this law, and she says it's really important.
The important thing is that when you're testing it, you need to be sure that it's correctly capturing votes. And so when you prepare to test it, having different numbers of votes for particular candidates that you insert and then expect to find in the results will tell you that.
Smith pointed to an incident in Pennsylvania last year as an example. It was a judicial retention question whether voters wanted to keep multiple judges.
So the way the question was worded, you could say yes to the first one, yes to the second one. You could say no to the first one, no to the second one. And they tested for those kinds of answers, but they failed to test for what would happen if someone said yes to one and no to the other. And as a consequence, there was a misprogramming that wasn't caught.
County officials there said that the machines ended up with a correct count, though it made for a confusing day. And it's for that exact reason the law exists, to make sure the computer is programmed correctly and can capture all potential results. So what happened in Wyoming?
It's possible that there's no misprogramming at all, just that the ballots didn't have the right marks on them, didn't have enough variance to be able to find any errors.
Smith says the good news there is that it's a really easy fix. Redo the ballots, make sure there are variants of numbers, and put them through the machine.
Well, there's still a little time to redo these tests to prepare for the upcoming election. There's no reason to think that the equipment has been misprogrammed, but this legal requirement does make sense to have these different numbers. So doing the test again with correctly prepared ballot for the test should show the functioning of the equipment.
If this is the issue that Wyoming counties are dealing with, it comes down to redoing or adding more varied ballots to another test. I reached out to the three counties that the Wyoming GOP specifically called out. Those were Goshen, Albany, and Laramie. Goshen and Albany counties both use test decks of ballots created on ES&S software, the company contracted for all Wyoming counties' voting equipment. Albany County's clerk says their test this year was consistent with how they've done it in the past. When they realized that the initial results went against the election code, both added ballots marked to make sure all of the votes in each race were different. They then redid all of the equipment tests. According to the Secretary of State office, Laramie County also redid their voting equipment test. However, the clerk there said no errors occurred and that she maintains full confidence in the accuracy and operation of all their voting equipment. For some Wyoming elected officials, this whole issue is just being blown out of proportion.
Well, I don't think there is a failure.
That's Lander Senator Cale Case.
It does appear that in Laramie County, the sample ballots had the same number of votes for both candidates. That is somewhat contrary to state law. But certainly that's something that can be rectified. I don't think there's any evidence that the number of votes that came out of being counted were wrong.
Case has been in the state legislature since 1993. He's certified election results and is the chairman of the Senate Corporation's Elections and Political Subdivisions Committee. When asked whether Wyomingites can be confident in voting on Tuesday,
I have so much confidence in our system in Wyoming. Mostly, though, my confidence is in those county clerks and their staff that work so hard to make sure that elections are perfect in Wyoming.
Stay with us as we hear from the losers and winners of the primary. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to the biggest headlines of Summer 2024 special Open Spaces. The results of the primary had some pretty major upsets. A big one was the Wyoming Speaker of the House and veteran of the cowboy state lawmaking world, Albert Sommers. He was defeated in his race for a Senate seat. Sommers' primary loss marks a larger shift in state politics, aligning more with the further right Freedom Caucus. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan helped us unpack this all.
On the night of the Wyoming primaries, a few dozen Sublette County residents gathered for music and food outside a local bar. It was an election party intended for all, no matter who you voted for.
In the House District 20,
local musician Jared Rogerson interrupted the crowd with results.
For Senate 14,
those were two races that people were paying attention to, even across the state. That's because local rancher Albert Sommers has led the Wyoming House for the past 2 years and served in this seat since 2013. His next political step was the Senate, so Sommers was running for a spot, and he was hoping to pass the torch of his House seat on to local sheep rancher Kat Urbikite. Both are aligned with the Wyoming Caucus, a more moderate, traditional Republican group, and both of them lost to opponents with farther right ideologies. Here's Urbikite.
This will make for some major changes in Wyoming and how things work. So we'll see how successful they are.
Urbikite is talking about the Freedom Caucus, a national far-right political faction that's gaining traction in the Wyoming Republican Party. Notably, Urbikite's opponent who won, LaBarge's Mike Schmid, isn't endorsed by the group, but he has donated $1,000 to the Freedom Caucus Political Action Committee. But Sommers lost to Laura Pearson of the Kemmer area by about 200 votes. That's according to the Secretary of State's unofficial results. And she is endorsed by the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. In an interview shortly after results were called, Sommers said this marks a new chapter for Wyoming politics.
I do have concerns, but ultimately, we will see how they lead, right? That remains to be seen. They haven't been in power before, so you can't say for sure how they will govern, but time will tell.
The Freedom Caucus made some gains in the primary, and depending how the general shakes out, could gain a majority in the state house. In the Senate, they endorsed four candidates, two of which won. Summer says he has concerns because the Freedom Caucus hasn't made his job easy. Tensions came to a fever pitch in the 2023 legislative session, even receiving national attention from outlets like Fox News.
Wyoming's GOP House Speaker is getting heat from his own party for blocking two Republican-backed bills.
One was touted as a don't say gay bill that would have limited what could be talked about in public schools. Summers said the bill would have stripped schools and communities of local control and that it might have been unconstitutional. And as Speaker, he let the bill die. Fast forward to this year's legislative session, and the Freedom Caucus had enough members in the House to circumvent Summers' leadership. They blocked 13 committee bills on day one in an attempt to curb government spending. This turned heads because committee bills are typically a shoo-in. Lawmakers and stakeholders spend months crafting them. And then this summer, the Freedom Caucus zeroed in on Summers' election campaign. Political action committees tied to the group accused Summers of being too liberal, something he pushes back on. So after the primaries were called, Summers said the negativity this campaign cycle was disheartening.
I was hoping Wyoming would reject that negativity, but they didn't. That seems to be a winning formula.
Even so, Summers said it's been a good political career. Highlights include passing tricky budgets during COVID and funding a trust fund for wildlife conservation. But he also said he just likes serving the people. He'll miss that.
It likely will feel weird, you know, come next January when everybody's gearing up to go to Cheyenne and I'm not. But, you know, life goes on. Life goes on.
Summers' House term ends in January, and Laura Pearson will step into the Senate seat that he lost. Pearson is new to the political scene. She's a fourth-generation sheep rancher in Lincoln County. She campaigned on being pro-ag and fossil fuels, against gender-affirming care for minors, against gun regulation, says life begins at conception, and supports limited government.
What got me engaged was COVID, obviously, and the 2020 election. Before that, I wasn't really into politics.
She said she only recently started testifying during public comment on bills.
I believe that the 2020 election was stolen from President Trump. And then during COVID, I didn't feel like our state was protecting our citizens.
There's been no evidence that there was fraud in the 2020 election. Pearson knows that hers was a close race and that Summers has many staunch supporters.
We can agree on some things and not agree on others, you know, but I'm here to represent the people. It doesn't matter whether they're not far right or not.
And although Pearson aligns with the Freedom Caucus, she says it doesn't mean she'll necessarily vote with them in lockstep. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
And now we hear from the winners. The Freedom Caucus gained seats in the primary. And we checked in with the former caucus chair, John Baer, to hear what he thought about the results. Baer was running uncontested in the primary for House Seat 31 that he has held since 2021. Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporter Chris Clements spoke with Baer.
What was your reaction about the news on Tuesday?
Well, it really blew me away because it was much more favorable than I anticipated.
What did the gains made by the Freedom Caucus in this past primary tell you about Wyomingites, how they're feeling right now?
I was not shocked by the fact that Wyomingites really supported the type of legislators that Wyoming Freedom Caucus represents. But I am thankful that the voters really came out strongly for those types of legislators. And, you know, these candidates really worked hard, so they deserve the credit for getting themselves into office. A lot of door-to-door work, a lot of communicating with the voters, and letting them know who they were, We did a tremendous amount of work trying to inform the voters on voting records so they knew which legislators to support and which ones really didn't match what we believe is the core values of the Wyoming voters.
And could you tell me just a bit about those core values?
Sure. I think one of the easiest ways to describe it would be that our voters, or our legislators and our voters, really believe in the 23 planks of the Wyoming Republican Party platform. And those are just real common sense things that have been a part of the platform for decades, really. It hasn't changed a great deal, maybe a word here or there. But for the most part, those are timeless principles. Those principles align with our Wyoming Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. So those things are, for instance, smaller government, pro-life, pro-family, pro-traditional family at that, and certainly pro-Second Amendment, with an understanding that our gun rights are really not about hunting, but they're about defending ourselves against a tyrannical government.
What does the Freedom Caucus hope to do in the next legislative session? I mean, do you have any priorities you'd like to get passed in 2025?
So I believe it's important that we do respond to the voters by providing them with the kind of return on investment of their votes, giving us a majority. And so I think what you're going to see is serious efforts to pass property tax reform and relief, things that were vetoed by the governor in this last session. And you're also going to see gun-free zones eliminated in the House of Representatives. You're going to see DEI funding for the university and the community colleges, the funding for that type of education, that woke education, if you will, is going to be limited, if not eliminated. And then I don't think we'll ever stop fighting for the unborn and protecting them. So you'll see efforts in that regard. The governor did veto an effort just this last session, and you'll see us continuing to work on that area. We want to keep porn out of our libraries, and we want to simplify state funding. So that's a real big task there. It's not real sexy for the people, but it'll take a lot of steps to kind of undo the complication that's been developed over the last several decades. I believe it's unnecessary. It is keeping our funding and our financing for the state from being transparent. And I believe it's important that every voter knows where the money goes, what's happening with their tax dollars, and what kind of stewards we are being with those dollars.
Are you concerned at all? I mean, I heard about a few incumbent losses as well, and I know those were, you know, part of the, many of them, the Wyoming caucus, but are you concerned at all with those incumbent losses this past primary that there might be a loss of institutional knowledge about the legislature?
Let me tell you, Chris, why I'm not concerned. Number one, the people who have put their names in to run for office in this regard, they're devoted to this state. They're devoted enough to really dig in and learn what they need to learn to be able to make good decisions. And the Wyoming Freedom Caucus has been doing that since its inception. And that is, you know, doing evaluations of bills, looking at the consequences of those bills and informing legislators so that they can make a good vote as far as an informed vote.
That was Representative John Baer, chairman of the House Freedom Caucus here in Wyoming.
Thank you for listening to this special Pledge Week episode of Open Spaces. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our digital producer. The entire show and all the stories you heard can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.